This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, July 1st, 2013. I'm Caleb Brown. It was a heartbreaking case all around, known simply as Adoptive Couple v. Baby Girl. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, discusses the Supreme Court's ruling and what it means for adoptive and biological parents and the institution of family law.
This was a case widely agreed to be heartbreaking, which arose under the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978. That was a bill passed by Congress after there had been reports that states were too easily taking kids away from Indian parents, declaring the parents unfit, putting them out for adoption or foster care. And so the law says that before any kid who is even eligible for membership in a tribe, and that's an interesting term of art, can have the parental rights cut off or can have custody switched to non-parents, there have to be a bunch of special procedures in which the tribe has to be given a right to get involved. Now, this case came up in Oklahoma when a woman of Hispanic background got pregnant. The father, it turned out, was 3/128 percent Cherokee, but enrolled in the Cherokee Nation. And that meant that he was about 2-point-something percent Indian, and the little girl around whom the case revolved was like 1.2% Indian. And the facts are somewhat disputed, but the courts have generally accepted the version that he relinquished his rights, that he made no effort to support the baby, and she assumed that the way was clear for adoption. Nonetheless, knowing that he had some Indian background, her lawyers for the adoption, and she lined up an adoptive couple in South Carolina, contacted the Cherokee Nation, but he used several misspellings of his name, and they checked the wrong name. So through no one's fault necessarily, the Indian tribe missed the chance to notice that there was a potential intervention it could do under ICWA. Next thing that happens is he decides that he does want to be a dad to this kid after all. By the time the South Carolina Supreme Court rules, she has been living for 2 years with the only parents she's ever known, the adoptive couple, and the South Carolina Supreme Court says, looking at ICWA, gee, this does seem to give him a second bite at the apple. It seems to give the tribe all of these rights. They did not correctly cross the T's and dot the I's, in part because of that mix-up. Out she goes. And admittedly, if you're going to be taken away from the only people you've known for 2 years, at least going to a biological dad is better than most of the alternatives, but still heart-wrenching. And now that the parents have won, although the case is not over, and to me the most heartbreaking sentence in the entire opinion was, we're remanding to the South Carolina courts for further proceedings. So it's going to go on, and they're going to have to spend more time arguing.
So it was my understanding from some of the early commentary that this was construed as a win for adoptive parents,
yes,
and but somehow a loss for biological non-custodial fathers. Why is that?
Well, the dissenters, and you had the classic trio of liberals, Sotomayor writing the main dissent, Ginsburg and Kagan, joined by Justice Scalia, which is interesting. And they had multiple grounds. And I would say the strongest point in the dissent is simply that if you read the text of the law, it does seem to favor the father's side at a first reading. And that meant that the majority had to do fancy footwork. So they've got a strong case from the language of the law. They've got a strong case from the general intent of the law. What Congress was trying to do was clearly give a bunch of power to Indian tribes, and letting the father win was consistent with that too. Sotomayor went on to say, and also, we ought to tread very carefully, especially because of the special bond between biological fathers and their kids. Now, Scalia, coming from a completely different Catholic conservative background, sort of seized on that, and that loomed larger probably in his thinking. My own reading of the liberals was that they saw it as a minority rights case having to do with a law that attempted to protect a long-trampled minority, and that was the important thing about and it was also easy to just go ahead and read the thing and find that it supported the father. But Again, with Scalia, who during the oral argument, Scalia clearly sympathized with the father. You could not say that about a lot of the other justices, because, you know, as always in these tragic human situations, there were lots of personal things going on. On the one hand, he hadn't paid for the kid. On the other hand, you know, there he was trying to step up for his responsibilities, better late than never. And, you know, everyone can imagine themselves being on either side of a situation like that. But clearly with Scalia, you had a triple combination of the sympathy factor, the special Catholic worldview that he brings, and the fact that Scalia has always been the big one for reading statutes literally.
What did the majority do here?
You had a majority that was first split three ways, because there was a concurrence by Thomas, a very interesting constitutional concurrence, and there was also a concurrence by Justice Breyer, who had crossed over from the liberal side. But what the majority did, led by Justice Alito, was basically take an editing pencil to the text of ICWA and slice out a few things here and there that seemed to make the law really unreasonable in order to make it a more workable and slightly narrower law. And they found some things that really were pretty unreasonable. For example, if you read ICWA literally, it looks as if it is imposing an obligation on the adoptive parents, often South Carolina, to hire social workers to convince the Indian father to want to be a custodial parent if he's initially reluctant, to pay for counseling, to make sure that he can't be talked into being a willing father. Now, as Alito said, you know, this is just ridiculous. You know, no adoption is ever going to go on under circumstances this onerous. So they began slicing away and trying to rationalize the law. And Alito seized on a couple of phrases. One of them was break up. Another one was transfer from a custodial parent. And he said, aha. Clearly, this wasn't trying to give the tribe a right to intervene in every situation where an Indian is a biological parent. Otherwise, it would cover sperm donors. And everyone was kind of uneasy about the sperm donor situation, which might indeed be covered by the law. So he said, you know, let's see what the law was really trying to do. It was really trying to prevent loss of parental rights where a relationship had formed to break up in the first place and where a father had custody. Now, that troubled the minority, and it also troubled Justice Breyer especially, who said, look, by reading it that way, you are suggesting that some very involved fathers who might not have custody but might have, let's say, visitation rights could also be cut off without the special procedures in this. And something where because Breyer split off with his concurrence and said, look, I agree with the majority, but we're going to limit this to kind of this situation, and we're not going to say anything about what happens when other types of fathers assert rights. That means there was not a majority for some of those implications. So that was Breyer. Thomas had a completely different and, as I say, a concurrence that repays a lot of attention, because he said, look, we all know what's going on, even if the majority won't admit it, which is that a lot of us on this court have our suspicions that ICWA may not be fully constitutional. And so what the court did was it cut it down under what's called the principle of constitutional avoidance, where if you've got a potentially unconstitutional law, you interpret it, even if it's not the most natural way to interpret it, you interpret it to dodge the constitutionality issues. And if you can do it that way, then you won't run into a possible collision. You can save a law that otherwise you might have to strike down as unconstitutional. Now, the majority did not admit that this is what they were doing, but you could tell at the oral argument, Roberts in particular was waving around flags of, you know, hey, isn't this possibly unconstitutional to grant all of these rights based on race? You know, this little girl is 256th Cherokee. Are we really going to make her complete future depend on that accident of lineage and things like that? Thomas, who is always a little more interested in reaching constitutional issues than most of his brethren, said, all right, I'll go along. We can avoid it, but I just want to point out that that's what we're doing. And while I'm at it, here's a big constitutionality problem that I see, which is you've got the federal government here invading the traditional province of state law, family law, one of the key areas that the federal government has left alone, and it's always been a state area. And when I look at the possible grounds grounds for overriding that, the Indian Commerce Clause, Sotomayor suggested treaties. But no matter what you look at, he said, I don't see where the federal government gets a right to begin dictating to state courts that they have to negotiate with some distant tribe. And that is fascinating for a number of reasons. It's part of Thomas's boldness on constitutional issues, his willingness to stake out new issues of where the federal government may have gone too far and need to be rolled back. It also might have implications, possibly, for the marriage cases. Certainly, the argument has been made on DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that it represents an improper ouster of the states from some control over family law.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at cato.org.